This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast that's designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of February 9th, 2026. This week, we've been talking about Arizona's iconic economic pillars known as the five C's: cotton, copper, cattle, citrus, and climate. And much like the other big C's, the cattle industry has changed dramatically as technology and population growth have transformed much of Arizona's landscape. But as Bridget Dowd reports, the state's cattle industry is still thriving, and by some measures, bigger than ever.
If you're in Phoenix, driving east on Washington, just past South 48th Street, you'll find a little piece of history. It's the Stockyard Steakhouse, established in 1947.
Pick out your steak. Comes with one side as your choice.
Today, it's sandwiched between the light rail, two freeways, and the airport. But in the early 1900s, this area was home to about 40,000 head of cattle.
So in 1919, the Tovery family, which was a cattle baron family, established the first cattle pens on Washington.
That's Gary Lasko, one of the restaurant's current owners.
There were a lot of cattle ranchers that brought them into the stockyards, sold them here. Then the Tovery family would feed them here. And then the slaughterhouse was right over on 48th Street.
There were about 200 acres of pens, and many people think it was the largest feedlot in the world.
The business grew and grew until 1947. They decided to build a small restaurant to feed all the cowboys working the stockyards.
Lasko says now, as one of the oldest steakhouses in the state, it's a shrine to Arizona's cattle industry.
We're doing everything we can to retain the history and the legacy of the restaurant and its connection to the cattle industry in the state of Arizona.
Tovery's cattle were moved sometime around 1970 because Phoenix was becoming more urban and people were complaining about the smell. Nowadays, to find a big ranch, you have to make a drive out of Phoenix to somewhere more rural like Skull Valley, where Jim Webb keeps his herd.
It's been awfully dry, and these calves aren't as big as we would normally expect.
Webb is a fourth-generation cattle rancher with 33,000 acres of land in Skull Valley and a 16,000-acre ranch in Globe.
We should have about 300 cows here, and we should have about 300 cows there. Because of the dry times, we're about half of that.
Less rainfall means less green feed for the cows to eat, so they have to supplement their diet.
That blue bucket says Vitalix on it. It's a molasses combination that's got a lot of energy in it.
When his father bought this property in 1951, their calves were sold locally. Now they get loaded up in trucks and sold to pastures in Texas, California, or Colorado, where they'll feed until they're big enough to go to a packing plant.
They'll be about a year and a half old by the time they get to that size.
Despite the drought cycle, Webb says he's able to keep his animals healthier than the cows of the 50s.
When my dad bought this ranch, you would only give them a little tetanus shot when you weaned them. Today we give them respiratory shots and help them to be very healthy.
There have also been advances in genetic technology, allowing ranchers to breed cows with certain traits like higher milk production or easy calving. On a statewide scale, the industry has grown tremendously and become more productive. George Friswald is a professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Arizona. He says agricultural census data shows that around the time the state was developing, the state had 32,000 dairy cows. Now there are about 200,000.
Those cows in 1920 produced 124 million pounds of milk. Now they produce more than 4.8 billion pounds of milk. Cattle and calves slaughtered in 1920 was less than 10,000. Now it's more than 500,000.
And farmers are able to get more product from fewer cows.
Milk produced per cow is like six times higher than it was in 1920.
There aren't as many beef cows as there once was, but Friswald says the amount of beef Arizona produces has remained steady thanks to advances in breeding, veterinary medicine, and nutrition.
Larger operations have computerized feed delivery, so the animals are getting the right mix of nutrients at the right time, and that's computer controlled, and there's even computerized milking machines.
In some ways, Arizona's cattle industry looks the same as it did 100 years ago. It remains remains a big part of the state's cultural identity, and you can still find cowboys gathering their animals on horseback on large, sprawling ranches. But they might have smartphones in their pockets with digital tracking or virtual fencing, and the cows have better genetics, producing more consistent, higher-quality beef than ever before. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The whole series is at 5.kjzz.org. In water news, the Colorado River is getting smaller thanks to climate change, and the states that use it are facing a deadline of this Saturday to agree on new rules about how to share water in the future. Negotiations have been stuck for months, but lately, policymakers have been hinting at a possible deal on the horizon. The catch? It might only last a few years. Alex Hager has more.
The Colorado River supplies nearly 40 million people and an agriculture industry that puts produce on shelves across America. With less water to go around, those users need to make big cutbacks to their take. Talks about how to do that were once looking decades into the future, but now, not so much.
What water managers want is flexibility in hard times.
Kyle Rohrink runs the nonprofit Great Basin Water Network.
For any water manager to be locked in a deal that gives them heartburn before they go to bed is a deal they're not going to want to take.
The seven negotiators in charge of the Colorado River must have been losing some sleep over the long-term options on the table, because after years of talks, they're starting to describe it like this. Either we agree on a short-term fix, or we take this to court. And we really don't want to go to court. Tom Buschatsky is Arizona's top water negotiator.
There is a strong desire, I think, among all seven states to avoid the litigation outcome. So if that means we could cut a deal for 5 years with a great likelihood that we won't have to litigate, great. If it's 2 years, maybe we buy into that.
The river's upper basin states, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, they haven't volunteered to cut any water and say the downstream states should do the heavy lifting. That's at the heart of this disagreement. So Buschatsky says a short-term deal may actually be just what the states need to break the deadlock. 5 years, he says, could be enough time to let those states figure out where they can cut back at a comfortable pace.
Sometimes people see boogeymen in, you know, we're going to have to conserve water. This is never going to work. And once you actually start implementing something like that, you learn how to live with it.
He says his camp of Arizona, California, and Nevada could use the time to learn how to deal with necessary water cutbacks, too. And it's not just the people in charge who are starting to support a short-term deal. Policy experts around the region are finding some positives. Catherine Terra is with the University of New Mexico.
In terms of timing, a five-year deal seems like it would be tight, but a five-year deal is better than no deal.
Terra says it could keep reservoirs from going dry while policymakers tackle bigger questions about the foundational laws that guide the river.
Coming to a deal, even if it's a five-year deal, gives people who drink the water and irrigators, farmers, folks working in agriculture, you know, guaranteed minimum water deliveries, which is crucial.
One thing a short-term deal probably won't do is give cities a clear picture of how much water they can use in 10 or 20 years. But climate change can give them some hints. Catherine Sorensen is the former water director for the city of Phoenix.
Whether some kind of deal, long-term or short-term, is reached, they can expect to have to plan for very deep cuts to their Colorado River availability. So that is already a certain thing for them.
Now the clock is ticking for states to get a deal to the federal government this week. They've missed similar deadlines in the past, but with the old rules expiring this October and a lot of federal paperwork that needs to be done before then, they are really running out of time. Jim Lockhead is Colorado's former water negotiator. He says a short-term deal helps states avoid the consequences of missing deadlines and sets the table for more talks down the road.
Where we are right now is trying to patch together something that will allow the system to limp along until hopefully that opportunity can be taken up again.
But that opportunity presents another problem. It means that states would have to go back to the negotiating table to figure out what comes next. Again, Arizona's Tom Buschatsky.
I tell you one thing, the people that have been in that room for 3 years are not looking forward to immediately starting to negotiate something after the first 5 years because it's been such a slog.
But he says it might still have some support if it keeps the states out of a courtroom. Alex Hager, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening.
Rio Salado College is hosting the Dash with Rio 5K and 10K Run Walk in Tempe on Saturday, April 18th. This community event welcomes runners and walkers of all levels with early bird registration for a limited time. Details at dashwithrio.com.
In politics news, a question posed at the Arizona Capitol last month was simple enough. Should U.S. citizens be the only people allowed to vote in state and local elections? But the wishy-washy answers from three lobbyists would soon go viral on social media. Cameron Sanchez reports.
The exchange took place during a legislative hearing in the Arizona House. Lobbyists for Rural Action Arizona, Living United for Change in Arizona, and the ACLU of Arizona were all testifying in opposition to a GOP-backed bill that would require county recorders to use a federal database known as SAVE to verify that a potential voter is a U.S. citizen. Critics have warned the database, originally used to check if foreign-born individuals are eligible for government benefits, has been overhauled by the Trump administration as an imperfect citizenship lookup tool. One that's in some cases erroneously flagged U.S. citizens as ineligible to vote. During the bill's hearing, Republican Representative Alexander Colladin pressed the lobbyists to answer, "Do you believe people should have to be U.S. citizens to vote in Arizona elections?" Colladin never got a straight answer, and so he kept asking again and again and again.
Was the answer a yes or was it a no?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Colladin, the ACLU's position is that every eligible...
I don't have an answer from that directly from Lucia.
Representative, that's a question that I have to go back for that very specific question.
The cyber ninjas found that there were no non-citizens on Arizona's board.
Colladin shared a produced video of the exchange on X, where it was seen more than 500,000 times on the social media platform.
I was shocked. I was absolutely shocked. You know, as I mentioned, usually when people in politics have an incredibly unpopular position, they try to hide it or cover it up, and that was just blatant.
He says the reason the lobbyists couldn't give him a simple yes or no is obvious.
It's that they want non-citizens to be able to vote in our elections.
Representatives for two of three organizations later told me answering Colladin's question isn't as simple as he says. Here's Amanda Melindo, Communications Director for the ACLU of Arizona.
We have our reasons. You know, we recognize that, you know, not every U.S. citizen is eligible to vote. So we almost never are willing to answer a simple yes or no.
Melinda said the ACLU was and is not advocating to let non-citizens vote. And she emphasized repeatedly that there's no evidence to show that non-citizens voting is a real problem. State law already requires Arizonans to prove their citizenship to vote in state and local elections. Arizonans who only declare their citizenship without documenting it can only vote in federal races. Antonio Ramirez, the political director of Rural Action Arizona, initially said Colladin was simply using a legislative hearing as an opportunity to grandstand on a non-issue. Still, why not give it a simple answer? That weighed on Ramirez, who called me back again because he said he wanted to address people who, unlike Colladin, may be asking the same question in good faith.
The reason we don't want to answer questions like that are because we don't want to add to the narrative that non-citizens are less deserving than citizens.
Ramirez emphasized that Rural Action Arizona is not advocating for non-citizens to vote, but he does sympathize with undocumented Arizonans unable to vote.
I was just thinking last night and imagining someone who's undocumented, who's lived here for 20, 30 years, and who's a good person that contributes to their community. And what kind of jerk would I be to tell them to their face that I don't think you should have the right to vote?
I asked Ramirez if that means he doesn't support Arizona's requirement for documented proof of citizenship before voting, even if he and his organization follow the letter of law as is.
I would say that, yeah. Well, gosh, that's a really good question. I don't know. I guess I feel conflicted about it.
Ramirez said he would feel less conflicted if it was easier for longtime undocumented Arizonans to gain citizenship, and with it, the right to vote under the law.
It's so impossible for so many people to do that. So like I said, like those questions that Colladin were asking, they're simplistic, but they're not simple. There's a lot to unpack within those questions.
Living United for Change Arizona was the only organization who did not respond to questions about their lobbyist testimony. As for the bill that sparked this viral moment, it passed out of the House on a party line vote with only Republicans in support. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
in education news. The Paradise Valley Unified School District has fired its superintendent. As Bridget Dowd reports from the education desk, Todd Cummings was placed on administrative leave in October, just a few months after starting his job there.
Cummings left his previous school district in Indiana amid allegations that grades had been manipulated. Paradise Valley's governing board later adopted a statement of 14 charges against him, including failing to disclose pertinent information on his job application. At a meeting this week, the district's attorney, Susan Siegel, said an investigation into Cummings found there was good and just cause to terminate his contract.
Dr. Cummings engaged in conduct that was in breach of the board policies and the agreement that he had signed with the district. He did not fulfill his duties. He created an unprofessional and counterproductive work environment. He did not encourage collaboration among his administrators and made decisions without input from them.
After hearing the findings, the governing board voted unanimously to fire Cummings. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In business news, Phoenix is adding more protections for workers exposed to extreme heat. The city in 2024 began requiring city contractors to provide water, shade, and heat safety training for outdoor workers. Now the city council is amending that ordinance, Catherine Davis-Young reports.
After the city passed its heat ordinance, airport workers continued to voice concerns that their employers were skirting some of the rules. So the city council is updating the ordinance to require employers to provide logs documenting that closed cab vehicles have functioning air conditioning. The amendment also specifies that workers can't face retaliation for reporting violations of the heat rules. Councilwoman Betty Guardado says the city will now have more authority when heat protections are not followed.
Every outdoor worker deserves to know that their health matters, that their concerns will be heard, and that the city stands behind them.
The city has also hired a new coordinator who will oversee the heat ordinance at the airport. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In Fronteras News, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, or ADEQ, says it's working with communities outside the city of Globe and the town of Star Valley on projects to address PFAS in water. Those are human-made chemicals linked to cancer and other health issues. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, Elisa Resnick has more.
PFAS don't break down naturally, and they raise health concerns when they seep into groundwater. Matthew Olson with ADEQ says the agency's working with small water utilities where the chemicals have been found.
These could be small mobile home parks, smaller communities that just haven't been connected to, you know, larger municipal systems yet, or they could be located on a county island.
Olson says the state is using a $5 million fund created by Governor Katie Hobbs's office to connect the smaller communities to larger water utilities, eliminating the need to build new infrastructure to remove PFAS from water. 2025 data from ADEQ shows 82 small water utility systems around the state had PFAS levels that were higher than the limit set by the EPA under the Biden administration. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And finally, from KJZZ's original production, The Show, a conversation with a former Border Patrol agent who turned activist on the misconduct she witnessed and why she left. Here's co-host Sam Dingman.
A new HBO documentary called Critical Incident: Death at the Border tells the story of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas. Hernandez Rojas died in 2010 after being handcuffed, beaten, and tasered by Border Patrol agents near the San Ysidro port of entry. At the time, the agents claimed that Hernandez Rojas had been violently resisting them. Subsequently, however, eyewitness videos taken at the scene called the Border Patrol's version of events into question. The documentary tells the story of the journalists, lawyers, and family members who pursued the truth about Hernandez Rojas's case. One of the most pivotal sequences in the film centers on a former Border Patrol agent named Jen Budd. Reviewing case files related to Hernandez Rojas's death, Budd discovers the involvement of a subset of Border Patrol called a critical incident team. These secretive groups, the documentary alleges, are tasked with manipulating evidence in agent-involved incidents. Budd's discovery alters the trajectory of the investigation into what really happened to Hernandez Rojas. Jen Budd is now an immigrants' rights activist in San Diego, and after I watched the documentary, I spoke to her about her role in the film and her experience as a Border Patrol agent, much of which she wrote about in a 2022 memoir called Against the Wall. Budd eventually left the Border Patrol because of things she witnessed while serving, including the work of critical incident teams.
I was an unusual Border Patrol agent in that I entered the agency with a
Bachelor of Science in Criminal Law from Auburn University. And I graduated at the top of my class with honors and was going to go to law school to be a civil rights attorney when I joined the Border Patrol. And I had run into these teams in the field in a couple of times when I responded to shootings. And I have witnessed them cover up scenes. In the scene that I had witnessed as an agent, fortunately, nobody had died. But obviously, if you continue down that line of logic, obviously, if somebody had died, then I would have been looking at the cover up of that. Mm-hmm. So when I was first asked to look at the Anastasio case, I was kind of I was like, I wonder if they're going to have the SIT teams in there. And sure enough, they did. I had no idea that they did this and used it in court because I was not one of the members of that team. And so it was shocking for me to actually see this. And then that's the only time I've ever seen that. So it was a mistake by that attorney that it went into a documentation like that. He's not supposed to do that.
And would you be able to share, Jen, just to back up, you had mentioned that you had witnessed a critical incident team during your own time with Border Patrol engaging in a cover-up. Are you able to say what you saw?
Yeah. So in that case, essentially, I was down on the border area in Campo, California, and there was an agent south of me right on the border wall line. A sensor had gone off. He got out of his truck to go after them. So we were trying to kind of sandwich the group in between us since I was north of him. And as I'm coming down a ravine south, I hear gunshots go off. And I announce over the radio that there's gunfire and we need assistance. And I went running south. All the people in the group had made it back south. And the agent was standing there with his gun in his hand and he had it up to his head. And he was like, oh, my God, I'm going to lose my job. And I'm like, what is going on? And he said, I got scared. And they came running back and I shot. And I'm like, do you think you hit anybody? And he says, no, I don't think I did. And I'm like, OK, just, you know, put your gun back in your holster and wait here. And this was back in the day when we had a lot more gaps in the wall. And so the way they ran south, there was a gap in the wall. And I went south to see if I could find anybody who was injured or any blood. And I did not see anything. I don't know if the Mexican Federales were ever called in that instant. And then I stayed on top of a rock as I watched the critical incident teams come in. And the supervisor, this was the first time I had understood what they were, that he's like, oh, there are guys, they're going to be a liaison, they'll look at the scene and this and that. They realized that nobody was injured, but they still had to protect the agent because they still had to do a report. And so if he's pulled his weapon and he's shot, then they need to show, and this is what you see in the cases today, with Renee Good and Mr. Preddy, is they need to show that the agent feels that his life was in danger for him to justify pulling that gun and shooting. Right. So then I watched these critical incident teams pick up rocks and throw them into the windshield and damage the truck that was not damaged at all.
Oh my God.
And yeah. And so they created the scene that they needed to justify that the agent was justified in pulling his weapon and shooting and that he feared for his life. And so that's how that case was written up.
Can I ask, one of the other really disturbing elements of the documentary is the description on the part of the person who, at the time of the documentary, at least, I'm not sure if this is still the case, is one of the heads of Border Patrol. He says, speaking of Border Patrol, we think of ourselves as paramilitary, not law enforcement. And then there's another speaker later in the film who characterizes the training that Border Patrol agents receive in the same way, that agents are encouraged to think of themselves as military actors in war zones, essentially, not as law enforcement agents, which would imply, obviously, a much different set of protocols. Are those characterizations consistent with your experience as a Border Patrol agent?
not when I first went through the academy, because I started at the beginning of 1995. So that was a year into this militarization of the Border Patrol. So I got to see a bit of the Border Patrol beforehand when we saw ourselves more as a civilian immigration law enforcement agency. Mm-hmm. But certainly I witnessed the militarization as it's come up. And it is true. They see themselves as a paramilitary organization. They do not believe, and we are trained this in the academies, that the First Amendment does not apply down here. So when you come through our checkpoints to go to a grocery store, you do not have the right to freedom of speech. You do not have the right to freedom of movement. The press does not necessarily have the right down here in regard to the First Amendment. You do not have your right to the Fifth Amendment to not utter a sentence that might incriminate you. So when you come through our checkpoints on your way to the grocery store or hospital or to work, we require you to state whether you are a citizen or not. And if you are not, then you must prove you have the legal right to be here. You have to prove that. We don't have to prove anything. You have to prove your legitimacy to us. And at the same time, we also are trained that the 14th Amendment doesn't really apply down here as well. And this is all consistent with the Supreme Court rulings of the 100-mile rule, that your constitutional rights are limited 100 miles from any land or water barrier.
Is there any sort of rationale given to agents in your experience, or is it more of a situation where it's just kind of said, and the expectation is that because of chain of command, agents will abide by these very incendiary claims?
It's because the majority of our enforcement is aimed at people who are undocumented. Mm-hmm. And the belief is that you're undocumented. If you cross that line, even though it is a misdemeanor, that you have invaded the United States. They will often say that they're like the Marine Corps of the Federal Service, and they are the last line of defense against invaders coming into this country. They do talk about it as a war zone. And so the language of the old patrol prior to 9/11 and the new patrol now is much different. It's way more militarized. The terms they use are different than the terms we used back in the day. And so we see a lot of this and a lot of the recruiting.
And if I'm hearing you right, part of that is this mindset that has been implemented of you're looking for terrorists, you're combating mm-hmm. terrorism. Mm-hmm. We'll have more of my conversation with former Border Patrol agent Jen Budd after the break. We continue now with my conversation with Jen Budd, a former Border Patrol agent who is now an immigrant rights activist. Based on her experiences with Border Patrol culture, I was curious to get her perspective on the recent tragedies in Minnesota, where U.S. citizens Renee Good and Alex Preddy were killed by ICE agents. It's important to note that ICE and Border Patrol are not the same thing. Border Patrol agents are generally responsible for enforcement at ports of entry to the United States, whereas ICE, as we've seen, often operates within cities. But under the Trump administration, the lines between the groups have blurred somewhat, and Border Patrol agents have taken part in recent immigration sweeps in Chicago, North Carolina, and Minneapolis. As you heard in the first part of our conversation, Jen Budd brought a unique background to her work with the Border Patrol, and I also wanted to know more about what prompted her to join in the first place.
Well, I was raised in Alabama in the 1970s. I was born in 71, so we didn't have the internet. And even when I graduated college with a degree in criminal law, I had never even heard of this thing called the Border Patrol. And we were not talking about this kind of stuff, at least in Alabama, in the early and mid 90s. And after I graduated from college, I wanted to go to law school. I went back home and I started having what I now understand is PTSD issues. I grew up in an extremely violent household. My mother was extremely physically violent and emotionally violent with me, a severe alcoholic. And and I decided I needed to, I decided I needed to get out of there. And this thing called the Border Patrol was hiring. I have known my whole life that I was gay. That was not something that was considered acceptable in my household. And I kind of join the Border Patrol to escape and get to California and start my life and live my life the way I wanted to. I had no idea I was leaving one abusive family and going into another one.
Hmm. What did you experience when you were there that makes you characterize it that way?
When we first got into the academy, the women in front of us came to our dorm rooms or townhomes at the time in the middle of the night to tell us what would be expected of us. They said, you're either going to date and have sex with your instructors in order to get through this academy, or you'll be raped into this academy, one or the other. That's the way it goes.
Oh my God.
And in my third month, I did the 4 months academy. In my third month, I was raped by a classmate. And at the time, quite honestly, even though I was older than most of the others and a college graduate, you just don't really think that this is really true. And it sounds kind of ridiculous that a whole base full of people who want to be federal law enforcement officers would be behaving this way. And I just wanted to get out to my station and prove that I could be a good agent. And what you're seeing in the streets does not surprise me at all.
Well, you have described in this conversation both personal abuses that you suffered while you were training to become a Border Patrol agent and explicit cover-ups that you witnessed happening by the critical incident teams. As you have watched the deaths of Renee Good and Alex Preddy and many of the other incidents that we have seen, what has gone through your mind in terms of what you know about the culture?
This is the culture of Border Patrol, and it's exactly what I'm used to, the ramming of the cars, and then saying that you didn't do anything, that they're the ones that rammed you. They do something that's going to get a lot of attention, like the shooting of Miss Good or Mr. Preddy, and then they immediately come out, even though they don't know the evidence, they don't know the whole situation, and they get into the media and they just hammer on the victim. The agents are always the victims. The victim is always the aggressor. You know, we go back to the film in 2010 with Anastasio, was they made sure to test his blood after he had already been injected with drugs that would restart his heart. By EMTs, to then turn around and put out into the media, oh my God, he tested positive for an amphetamine. Well, of course he did. They're trying to pump and get his heart started. Of course he did. And so what we see in this video of Mr. Preddy is just more demonizing of the victim and saying, oh, look, he kicked our taillight out. Well, that may be, but that's not worth a death sentence. So, you know, unfortunately, these agencies, I feel both ICE and Border Patrol in particular, they've violated the Constitution. They're killing Americans. I feel that those agencies, quite honestly, are beyond reform. The cultures are so embedded in them. And I'm not saying we don't need enforcement along the border. We do. But I do not believe that these agencies and the management of these agencies are up to the task.
Well, I have been speaking with Jen Budd, who is a former Border Patrol agent. She's the author of the memoir, Against the Wall, My Journey from Border Patrol to Immigrant Rights Activist. And she appears in the new HBO documentary, Critical Incident, streaming now. Jen, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Katina Foundation, Basis Charter Schools, and Palo Verde Generating Station, SRP, and the Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online, and on the KJZZ mobile app.